This is the Line 4 podcast. I'm Will Bardwell. You know that scene in The Matrix where the guy shows Keanu Reeves what the computer code for The Matrix looks like? And it's just a black screen full of green numbers and characters pouring down. It doesn't look like anything discernible, but the guy tells Keanu Reeves that he doesn't even see the code anymore. He just sees what it's producing. Blonde, brunette, redhead. If you've ever been to a golf course construction site, it's easy to feel the same way. The folks who are working on it will tell you, oh, here's the second green, or hey, look at this bunker. And they can really see it, even if the shaping has been minimal. To the uninitiated, though, it all tends to just look like a lot of dirt. I think that's a result of the fact that there's a lot of mystery around golf course construction, even though, ironically, it's the part of golf course design that takes place out in the open. I mean, think about it. People intuitively understand the first major step in the process, right? Routing. The golf course architect inspects the land for the golf course, finds a bunch of spots that would be really good places for greens or tees or hazards, goes back and figures out the best way to make those puzzle pieces come together, and finalizes the route that the golf course will follow. That's routing. And people intuitively understand the last major step in the process, growing. You throw a bunch of grass seed on top of everything, or if you're really lucky, you roll a bunch of sod out and let the grass grow until it's healthy enough to support people walking all over it and playing golf on top of it all day. That's a grow-in. But the stuff that happens in the middle of those two things, the actual construction, is a bit of a mystery to me. I mean, people understand that it involves a bunch of folks running bulldozers and pushing dirt around, and somehow at the end of it, you've got something that you can grow grass on and play golf on. But how exactly? I mean, think about your favorite green that you've ever played. All that contouring and detail, all those little rolls and subtle tilts. A lot of that wasn't on the architect's blueprint. That was figured out on site, imagined right there, and then made to happen with a gigantic machine that weighs as much as an Apatosaurus. How? So, today on the Line 4 podcast, we're heading to Memphis, where Rob Collins, Tad King, and their team are redesigning the links at Overton Park, a historic 9-hole public golf course right in the heart of the city. When I arrived on a very windy day in the spring, the team was about 2 months into its work. And true to form, my form, that is, there were still spots on the golf course where it was hard to see much more than a lot of dirt. But in other places, the vision was coming together.
One of my favorite things about this course is the quirky tee shots that make you uncomfortable. It's not long, it's like 2,300 yards. And here we are on 3T, dog leg left around the edge of the forest, and you can't see the green at all, and you kind of feel not great.
That's Rob Collins. He and his partner, Tad King, did Sweetens Cove right outside Chattanooga, Tennessee, and are working in Nebraska on Landman Golf Club, which is a really breathtaking design that'll open in 2022. At first glance, Overton Park appears to be a very different animal than either Sweetens Cove or Landman. Restrained, nuanced, even traditional. And more on that later. But Collins explained that no matter what kind of golf course is being built, the fundamental concerns are always the same. It's a constant dance between artistry and engineering, form and function. And on an outdoor site, where the construction material is dirt, the first concern is a practical one. Keep it dry. And when it gets wet, get the water off of it.
Here's a simple breakdown of shaping golf courses. The number one thing that you worry about is where's the water going?
That's Mark Berger. He's been shaping golf courses for more than 30 years and is driving a bulldozer for Collins and King at Overton Park.
So we have to control water on a golf course. You don't want water running in bunkers. You don't want water running on greens. And you want to try not to channel water as much as you can. You want it to more sheet flow over a flatter area, because when you channel water, you get giant washouts. you control your water, then you need to make it look like a golf course.
A quick aside here. You know what else is great for controlling water? A towel. And lucky for you, Line 4 golf towels are still in stock. The towel is blue with a big white Line 4 logo, and it's got that nice waffle style weave to it. Golf towels are one of those things you can never have too many of, but I promise you, this one will quickly go to the top of your rotation. It's on my bag right now, and I'm not taking it off anytime soon. Line 4 golf towels are $24 each, plus $2 for postage, and it's a great way to support the storytelling that you get at Line 4, both on the website and now on the podcast. The demand for these things has been way beyond what I imagined, so if you've already ordered one, thank you. If you haven't, though, it's not too late. Shoot me a direct message on Twitter, either at Will Bardwell or at Line 4, and I'll send you my Venmo handle so we can get you a Line 4 towel on your golf bag and let you show your support for Line 4. Now, back to the show. When Collins and King got hired to renovate Overton Park, the job came with a couple of caveats. Most importantly, the park's old-growth forest couldn't be disturbed. Memphis is home to a beautiful 10,000-year-old virgin forest right in the middle of the city in Overton Park. When the feds tried to run an interstate through the park in the 1960s, a local group sued to prevent the park's destruction. The case went all the way to the United States Supreme Court, and the citizens group won. 3 votes on the Supreme Court go the other way, and none of this is here today. The forest, the golf course, the park, none of it. Hell of a thing. Which is why so many people have wanted to put this kind of work into restoring and preserving the golf course for a long time. Overton Park is special, and it deserved a golf course worthy of that esteem. But since the forest couldn't be touched, King and Collins had to stick with the golf course's original routing. That meant that most of the work to be done at Overton Park came down to reshaping fairways and building some interesting greens. But even within those limitations, there was still a lot of improvement that was possible. For example, here in the third and fourth fairways, they've added a lot of tilt, which will improve shot values, but also will help move rain off the golf course. Again, form and function, creativity and utility. When I visited Overton Park in mid-March, the site had taken a lot of rain, and even snow, over the past couple of months. But by the time I arrived, they hadn't gotten much rain for a couple of weeks. That's pretty rare for that time of year. And it was a window when they knew they had to get a lot of work done, not just shaping greens and whatnot, but also working on the course's surface drainage, so water would drain off the work site faster the next time they got a big rain. Which brings us back to Mark. He's explaining 2 different types of water flow. There's channelizing and there's sheet flow. So, for example, imagine that you're standing on your roof. And by the way, don't stand on your roof. That's dangerous as hell. But imagine that you're standing on your roof and that you've got a bucket of water in your hand. First, imagine that you pour the water into a gutter. Now, imagine the shape of that water as it's in the gutter. It's kind of wrapped together, almost like a tube of sausage, and it rushes downhill until it finds the downspout, and it flows down and out, all the while maintaining that solid, wrapped together shape. That's water that's been channelized. It moved off the site in a channel. Now, in contrast, imagine that instead of pouring the water into a gutter, you walk all the way up your roof to its highest point, and seriously, do not do that. And you just pour the water out onto the roof itself. Now what's the water doing? What shape is the water? It's flat, right? It's more like a sheet of paper. And that's oversimplified, but it's more spread out, right? That's sheet flow. And depending on what exactly you're trying to do at any given place on a golf course, sometimes you want to channelize water, and sometimes you want sheet flow.
So the first thing you got to do is control your water. And after you control your water, then you need to make it look like a golf course. So you have to, so while you're shaping and moving along, okay, I'm having water go over here. Okay, that's going to turn into a swell. Now I need to come up to a high so that, you know, so it's down, up, down, up. But then you can't get repetitive the same height. So you, then you're down up this high, then you're down up this high, then you're over here, and then you're over there.
And what Mark is getting at there is that the trick to all this is that those contours designed to move water off the golf course can't be built with nothing but utility in mind. They can't all look the same, right? Because contours in nature don't all look the same. So the shaper has to build these contours that are designed to move water in such a way that the contours look natural. More to the point, the contours have to fit with the setting around the golf course. Otherwise, it just looks weird and out of place. This is what golf course designers call a tie-in. That is, they tie the golf course design in with its surroundings. Garrett Morrison did a great explainer episode about tie-ins on the Fried Egg podcast last year. It's episode 279, if you want to learn more. But when Collins and his team are looking at tie-ins, one thing they look at is the ground on the edges of the golf course. Do the first 10, 15 yards of the ground on the golf course side of the property line look like the first 10 or 15 yards of the ground on the other side of the property line? Collins specifically mentions Pinehurst number 2. And if you've ever seen Pinehurst number 2, that makes sense because that golf course just seems to sit on the ground like it belongs there. And Collins says that something as simple as being able to look just off the golf course and see the base of a tree, it's enough to convince your brain that that ground over there and this ground over here are the same. That's a golf course that's tied in. But if the contours that your shaper built to channel water off the course don't allow for a view like that, then there's just something about it that the human brain can't accept. It feels separate somehow, and it's not tied in. And this is what I'm talking about when I say that this whole thing, the whole job of actually building the golf course, it's a constant juggling act that has to account for artistry, engineering, playability, and a good golf course doesn't drop any of those balls. It's not easy, and it creeps into every decision that gets made during construction.
Ideally, what I would like to have happen is when this project is finished, to have it look like this ground wasn't really disturbed and all we did was just build, you know, a couple of bunkers here and there and some really interesting greens. Mm-hmm. And what that means, like for this hole, for instance, is we did just a little bit of shaping to kind of help direct some of the water, create some swales, to channelize the water and in control, control that a little bit better than it was pre-construction, because, you know, like a lot of golf courses, it, you know, would stay wet in spots. And so we're trying to basically just improve the drainage, in the shaping is all centered around that. And, you know, in spots, we're creating some visual interest with that. You know, maybe we carve out the swales a little deeper, create a little channel where it looks like maybe the water ran over a long time and carved out the earth. And that can create some visual interest, possibly even some strategic interest. But for the most part, it's been just trying to make the land work better. It's interesting. We're focusing on the same type of details, shot making interest, options, etc., like we are on a giant canvas, you know, that we have out at Landman, but it's on a much, much smaller scale. And like the types of details that we're thinking about are just smaller and smaller in size, and maybe not quite as many, just because of the size of the project.
The third and fourth holes, where we're standing right now, are a good example of that. They run alongside one another, with the high side of this area being the left side of the third fairway, which borders the forest. And then at the fourth hole, you tee off in the opposite direction. So the fairway is now tilted from right to left. If you want to visualize it, hold your arms straight out in front of you. Go ahead, do it. Now, keep your arms straight, but kind of lean toward your right. Got it? Okay, so your left arm is the third hole. You tee off from your left shoulder and play down to your left hand. And if you really want to be accurate about it, you could hyperextend your left elbow to give you that right to left dog leg. And then for the fourth hole, you tee off from your right hand toward a green on your right shoulder. And when it rains, where's the water going? Off your right elbow, right? Same thing at Overton Park. Now, funny thing about that fourth green.
This is, we're at the entrance to number four green. This is a really cool green that Trevor shaped. And it just sits right on the ground. We're in the approach, and then like now we're on the green and there's no grade change whatsoever. Right. And then it just kind of slowly bleeds up into this front plateau, and then there's a dip in the middle, and then a back plateau. And it's kind of sits on a little bit of an angle. It's kind of a cousin of a Biritz, I guess.
He's underselling it. It's very Biritz-y. Very cool. Your typical Biritz green is sort of a long shape with a channel dug through the middle so that the two sides of the green are separated from one another. And a shot onto the wrong side of the green requires a putt down and back up the slopes of that channel. Now, imagine a Biritz that's been kind of tipped up onto one side so that the right side of the green is higher than the left. Now, if you're putting from the wrong side of the green, your putt has to account not only for that channel, but for that downslope from the right side of the green to the left. That's the fourth green at Overton Park. Very cool. And because the grade of this area is already sloping down from right to left, the fourth green just sits right on the ground. It's super creative. But it also looks like something that just got happened upon rather than shaped. Now, we've walked off the fourth green, and we're on the fifth tee, looking up toward my favorite green on the course. But more on that in a second. As we're standing on the fifth tee, Collins looks over at the fourth green, where a well-meaning irrigation contractor is about to ruin everything. Remember that really cool green I told you about? Well, this irrigation contractor is in a little backhoe, driving onto the green, and he's about to dig a trench right through the middle of the green to install his irrigation, right through the middle of it. Apparently, this sort of thing is frowned upon. I don't know anything about irrigation, but I do know that I like the fourth green, and I don't want anybody digging it up at this point. And luckily, Collins agrees. So he runs back over to the fourth green, spends a few minutes clearing things up with this contractor, and walks back to the fifth tee, shaking his head, but relieved at the disaster that was just averted.
I just saw a guy about to dig a line right through the middle of our fourth green. I think the irrigation contractor was confused about what was exactly the green surface and what wasn't, and we prevented that. So, it's a construction project, and there's a lot of things that go on, and a lot of quality control and making sure things are done right.
Hypothetically speaking, let's say this golf course is being built by somebody who is building the golf course, designing the golf course from his desk 2,000 miles away. What happens back there when, you know, irrigation contractor, you know, in a little bit of miscommunication, thinks, okay, this is where we go, and it turns out he's digging in the middle of the fourth green? What happens if you're not here?
Well, they would have dug through the middle of the green, and then the architect would have come in and probably noticed that there was an irrigation line running right through the middle of the green. And then he would have asked the contractor why that happened, and then the contractor probably would have made up some excuse or something, and then they would have started yelling at each other, and then it would have gotten fixed, but there would have been a cost associated to it with it that potentially could have been passed off to the client. So
back to the fifth hole. This is one of only two holes on the golf course with bunkering. But like any good hazard, it dictates everything that happens on this hole. It's right on line with the green off the tee, but with room to miss left. And it's got this big flashed back so that if you lay up in front of the trap, your shot into the green will be blind. You could play out to the left, although the angle into the green isn't ideal from there. But if you can drive your tee shot just over the sand trap, the ball will kick off the back of that flash and kick right down to the green. And let's talk about the fifth green, because this is a good example of just how much control shapers have out here to identify problems and opportunities and seize on. Here at the fifth green, for example, Collins is over the moon about a punch bowl green that Mark has just finished shaping. It's got this beautiful flashed back that finishes at ground level with the neighborhood right behind it, so it's really well tied in. But about halfway into the green, it's also got this spine running from the left side to the right side, which almost creates two separate tiers in front and back. The easiest way to enter the green is from the right side, and the farther left a tee shot finishes, the harder the approach into the green gets. But even so, the sides of the punch bowl are high enough that you could pop a hybrid along the ground, let the ball roll up along the right side, and sling it around over to the left side. It's a really creative, functional green with a lot going on, but without so much that it looks out of place. And for the most part, it was all Mark.
So we just said put a punch bowl green in here, make it look like, you know, there was an economy of construction and there was, you know, small amount of dirt as moved as possible to build this cool looking punch bowl green. And then Mark, to his credit, you know, took it and ran with it. And now there's this really neat spine that kind of protrudes on the right hand side and in the left hand side. And when I was standing out there with you looking at it, there's a really neat back right and back left pin that are harder to get to because of the contouring that Mark created. And that's to his credit. That was his idea. And we talked about it and it worked out great. So, you know, if you hit a shot that comes in and lands just a little bit short of that, you're going to spin down and be left with an awkward putt, potentially a three putt. Whereas if you throw it just a little bit farther, I mean, you're going to be dead at the hole.
And that raises an interesting point. And this is where golf course design goes from theory to application. It's one thing to have a great idea. It's one thing to be able to see in your mind's eye this really cool contoured green or some subtle knob out in the green surrounds. It's even one thing to be able to communicate that idea effectively. But turning that great idea into a great green requires the shaper to execute on that idea's details, on its subtlety. And subtlety is a matter of degree, literally. Meaning a shaper has got to be able to create minuscule differences in degrees of slope with a bulldozer.
So we're on sixth green right now, and how do you know when you have it right? Especially like on a reverse Redan where the grade is so important. Like, how do you know when you have it right?
A lot of it is feel. Just years and years of building greens and feeling what a 1% pin is or what a 2% pin is when you're sitting in a bulldozer. You get to the point where you can feel just what the break is on the green. And of course you come back and you check it with a laser at some point, but 9 out of 10 times when we come back and check it, it's dead on the money. And that's just years and years and years of building greens and feeling 1%, 2%, 3% pins, 10% flashes, 12% flashes, and you get a feeling of what it is when you're in the machine. So it's just repetitiveness of over and over and over of building greens and what you know, it's a skill level that you get to.
Mark heads back to his bulldozer to keep working on the sixth fairway. Collins and I keep walking. Overton Park is effectively divided into two halves. The old growth forest in the heart of the park separates the third, fourth, fifth, and sixth holes from the seventh, eighth, ninth, first, and second holes. On this part of the course, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth holes. Work is nearly complete. But down the hill, on the other side of the forest, the other half of the course is still in a formative stage. It's a hell of a juxtaposition. I mean, back at the third and the sixth, Collins' team is just finishing off details. All the hard questions have been answered. But down here at the eighth hole, which runs right along Poplar Avenue, Collins and King are still wrestling with practical and artistic puzzles that have been solved elsewhere.
So one of the things we were talking about is like making sure that players can see the bases of trees and using that to keep the golf course tied into its surroundings. But when you're at, what are we at, number eight?
We're on number eight.
Yeah, so this is a pretty flat part of the property. It runs right along Poplar Avenue. It's going to be tough, like, because you could shave all this down dead flat and you'd be able to see the bases of trees and it would be tied into the grade at Poplar Avenue, but then it would be a really boring golf hole. And then again, you could do a ton of shaping around here and it'd be a really cool golf hole, but then it wouldn't be tied in with the surroundings and you wouldn't be able to see any of the bases of trees and it would look weird. So like, how do you find that balance on a part of the property like this that is just unavoidably flat?
So right now, I mean, we're having a little bit of a, you know, working through some edits on that. You know, the first round of shaping that came in here, you know, kind of like we were doing over on number three, a lot of it is about channelizing the water and just getting it moving the way we want to. And the guys were shaping over here at a time when the snow and the ice and the rain were imminent. And, you know, the dirt is close to being in the right place, but now we're at the stage where we've got to refine it and really, really sell the natural appearance of this. And there's a ridgeline along the right-hand side of the hole that, to me right now, is aggravating me because it looks a little too much like what I would call like a modern arrow, you know, bulldozer shaped ridgeline. And we need to take the air out of it, get it down on the ground a little bit more. And we are going to have a bunker on the right hand side here, but we need to build that bunker in such a way that there's a kind of an economy of construction and only the exact amount of dirt moved to build that bunker. You know, there's some, you know, place that comes to mind is an example of Hollywood up in New Jersey where they, you know, just enough dirt was moved, you know, to build some really cool visual bunkers. This is an area where the people, you know, kind of behind this project were really interested in seeing us add some bunkering because it does border Poplar. And, you know, that requires adjusting the grades on the right-hand side of this hole. And we're trying to do that, but we want it to be done in such a way that it's a minimal amount, but you still get that visual pop and the strategic pop of where this bunker is. It kind of pinches down the fairway, and right now we're at the stage where the first edit has gone through, and now we're going to make, you know, two or three more edits to kind of get that right.
Coincidentally, or maybe not coincidentally at all, this is exactly the same challenge that Collins and King tackled at Landman. Now, no one is ever going to confuse Landman with Overton Park. One is on a super hilly, super rural site that sprawls over hundreds of acres, and the other is a lovable little nine-holer on a piece of mostly flat land tucked between a couple of neighborhoods in a major city. But the energy being spent toward tie-ins at Overton Park, confirming over and over that the course fits in its surroundings, that's exactly the same thing that happened at Landman. Now, the surroundings at those two sites couldn't be more different, but the goal is the same. And the goal is moving as little dirt as possible to achieve that balance between form and function. At Landman, a lot more dirt had to be moved than at Overton Park, but that's because of the differences in those sites, not because of any differences in design philosophy. All of which is to say that when people visit Overton Park, there will be a temptation to describe it as being worlds apart from Landman, and that's not true, because the design philosophy that's guiding King and Collins here in Memphis is no different than the one that led to Landman, or Sweetens Cove, for that matter. if you're determined to point to differences between Overton Park and what King Collins has done at Landman and Sweetens Cove, it would have to be that at Overton Park, they've chosen to err on the side of restraint. That's not to say that Overton Park is restrained, but where the project has presented a choice between going nuts and throttling back, King and Collins have chosen to throttle back. We're at the first green now, and this is a good example of that choice. The first fairway runs along the right side of the street that enters Overton Park. The first green is right in front of another little driveway that leads to a children's playground. So the first green is tucked right between those two streets, one on the left and one in back. And Collins doesn't like it. So he's decided to build in a little more margin for error by pulling the green back toward the fairway to create more room to miss the green. Now, keep in mind, Overton Park is already a really short golf course. Collins and King's routing comes out to about 2,250 yards and plays to a par of 34. And the first hole was already going to be short, around 290 yards from the tips. And now Collins is talking about making it even shorter. But that decision says a lot about how he and King see their jobs.
We're talking about a golf course that's already going to be a really short golf course. Do you worry about pulling the green back, shortening the hole up even more, and losing even more yardage than you've already got?
Well, it goes back to a comment I made earlier about playability being the final trump card, and here playability will win out over the question of yardage, and it's far more important that people have a little bit of runway over the back of the green to play golf, you know, particularly being the first hole. You know, we need to move this green forward to the concept and the shaping are all great. It's sitting right on the ground. It's doing what it's supposed to do. But right now it's just, it's too difficult and there's not enough room to play. So we're gonna shift this entire green forward, center of the green, probably come forward 20 yards or so.
It occurs to me that this tension between artistry and practicality, this is not so different than the internal debate that golfers face over and over again on a golf course, or at least on an interesting golf course. Do I play the exciting shot here or something more conservative? Do I play for a big, heroic hook shot over this hazard, or do I swallow my pride and lay up? Heck, finding a balance between utility and what feels right, that's literally the art of the golf swing. That tension couldn't be any more fundamental to the game of golf. So it shouldn't be any surprise that it's also at the heart of turning a set of blueprints into an actual golf course. Of course it is. And as Collins and I are walking back through the Old Forest, back toward the third hole where we started, I ask him one more time about his decision to pull that first green forward. And he says something that I didn't record, but that says a lot about where he thinks Overton Park will fall in the golf landscape. He says that the thing that he didn't want to happen was that he didn't want some 10-year-old kid to hit a great approach shot that barely missed the green and left that kid with a tough chip shot that would make him hate golf. What a realization that decisions made on bulldozers by drivers pushing around literally tons of dirt will determine whether a child enjoys golf or hates it. It's inevitable that kids will grow up playing this golf course. Overton Park is surrounded by neighborhoods, after all. Decades from now, those kids will tell stories about growing up on that golf course, and those stories will turn on decisions that are being made on those bulldozers this spring. There's a lot of engineering that goes into the job, but being able to shape childhood memories from years in the past on a bulldozer? That's an art. Well, that's episode 2 of the Line 4 podcast. And if you're new to the Line 4 podcast, welcome. I hope you liked what you heard. If you did, please subscribe and leave a 5-star review wherever you download your podcasts. If this podcast is your first time running into Line 4, then please check out the website, line4.com. And hit me up on Twitter at Will Bardwell and at Line 4. And if you'd like to support Line 4, don't forget to buy a Line 4 golf towel. It's only $24 plus $2 for postage. Shoot me a direct message on Twitter at one of those handles, and I'll send you my Venmo info. This has been the Line 4 Podcast. I'm Will Bardwell, signing off.